Okay, no problem.
Hi, LA Progressive friends and readers. Dick and Sharon back, editor and publisher of LA Progressive. We welcome you back again. We're excited that you're hearing here. And we're here with somebody we've known a long time. I mean, 20 years or so. A prolific author, world traveler, one powerful article after another about the global South, basically Latin America, Central America, the Middle East, Africa and Asia, powerful stuff, lots of articles. You write all the time. He's joining us from his office in Santiago, Chile. Good to see you, Vijay.
It's great to be with you, and I'm glad we both have books behind us.
Yeah. I mean, books help to shape us, and we're so happy. I was just taking a look at your book, Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. I refer to it frequently. And I always get something new out of it. And I appreciate, and I think that anyone listening to this who is not familiar with Vijay Prashad's work, you should Google him, Vijay, V-I-J-A-Y, Prashad, P-R-A-S-H-A-D. But Vijay, you have a website, an organization. You want to tell, what is your website so that people can get those books?
Yeah, well, more just to see the work that's there, it's thetricontinental.org. And it's a research institute that's based, you know, as Dick was saying, in the global south. Basically, our idea is to build knowledge from the ground up, from people who are struggling, because part of our basic understanding of knowledge systems is that those who are trying to change the world have a really good sense of what the world is like. You know, if you are a, let's say, a liberal, and you think, well, you know, the law is a great instrument, and let me write the history of the United States based on the laws, you don't really understand the United States, because, you know, the law might say, well, you're all equal before the law. But let's see how it operates. Let's see how people who are, let's see somebody who's trying to do police reform, for instance, they have a really good understanding of repression, you know, because they see it from the constraints, not from the ideals. And I always say, you know, Sharon, that if you want to understand the values of a country, don't read the Constitution, read the budget. You know, how the government decides to spend money is the values, not the constitution. That's, you know, that's what your parents teach you.
Right.
It's much better to check somebody's criminal record.
Oh, I love it. I love it, Vijay. I swear. You're absolutely a treasure. So I sent an email to you yesterday because I had heard about this first ever public gathering and the first meeting since the Cold War of Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and Kim Jong-un. And I wanted to get your take on what you thought this meeting symbolized, or not just merely symbolizes, what does it actually mean for Americans? And I'll just be very frank here, for marginalized Americans like me, a Black female senior. What does this mean?
Well, look, you know, in a way, I should say first that they gathered together, the three of them and other leaders, the president of Cuba, the president of Belarus and others, they gathered together to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the victory in the war against fascism. On September 3rd, 1945, was the date when Japan surrendered. This is very important as a starting point in Asia, because unlike for the United States, World War II begins in Asia in 1937. And in a real sense, doesn't end until 1949, until the Chinese Revolution. That means, let's take the lesser number, 1945. It was 8 years of industrial scale war in Asia. If you add on the extra 4 years till the Chinese Revolution, it's 12 years of industrial scale war. In Europe, the war starts in 1939, 2 years later than the Marco Polo Bridge incident. So even that, if you take the shorter period in Asia, it's 2 years longer. Secondly, we did a calculation at Tricontinental, and we'll be publishing this study, which we've done, which is a comprehensive study of World War II deaths and destruction. What we found was that something to the order of 50 million Soviet citizens and Chinese patriots and communists died to defeat fascism. 50 million. The US number is not even a million. The European number is much lower than that. I mean, the Soviet Red Army destroyed perhaps 80% of the Wehrmacht, of the German army, 80%. And yet, in the northern imagination, in the imagination of the West, this enormous sacrifice of, the Soviets and the Chinese in the war against fascism of the European variety and Japanese militarism is underappreciated. And why Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, because don't forget that you could actually go even further and say that World War II starts in 1937 and continues in the Korean Peninsula until the armistice. I mean, the war has not ended in the Korean Peninsula, but at least until the armistice, which takes you 10 more years. Remember, the entire North was destroyed. So they made a statement, the three of them being right there at the podium, saying we took the brunt of fighting fascism, and look at you now, you are welcoming fascism back into your midst. This is a very significant political statement. We are not warmongers, they said, but you are. And we commemorate what it took for our people to destroy fascism, but you are standing with the fascists, whether it's in Ukraine or whether it's in the UK, where Keir Starmer has been making extremely, unpleasant comments about migrants and so on. United States, I don't need to tell you, it's an open and shut case of the, shall we call it flirting with fascism? Not sure exactly what the phraseology is. Democratic Party fallen on its face, unable to directly confront the menace, that appeared. So they made a really important point. And I think that is underappreciated. Trump's reaction was, oh, you guys just hate America. And, but America's the greatest. His tweet was hilarious. America's greater than all of you put together. Well, okay. But, let's, and he was right to say, well, Americans also died in Asia. That's true. That is true. I mean, we know that. But it's equally true that the weight of sacrifice is extremely uneven. And then, just to add to your last comment, Sharon, about marginalized peoples and so on, let's also face facts that on the battlefields of Europe, there were lots of Africans who came through the so-called colonial armies, the French colonial army, lots of Indians. My two uncles died in that war. My grandfather fought in that war in Italy and so on. I mean, these people played a role that's underappreciated. You watch any Hollywood film on World War II, you don't see soldiers from Senegal or soldiers from India or soldiers from Tunisia. You just see young farm kids that look like Tom Hanks, landing at the beach at Normandy, and under fire. But a lot of the frontline troops actually were old colonial soldiers. And even that is underappreciated. The loss of life wasn't so enormous like in the Soviet Union and in China, where it's just, I mean, it's hard to imagine 50 million, but there it is. That was the message from Beijing on the 3rd of September.
Wow. So, I look at this and I ask you, is it symbolic? So aside from the meeting representing an acknowledgement of this really important milestone, is there something that is happening on the geopolitical front, like something like BRICS, Is there something that's happening that is a clear indication that the United States is not the world power that it had been since World War II?
Well, let's go a couple of days before this September 3rd gathering in Beijing. There was a meeting in Tianjin, which was the meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Now, this group is an interesting group. It was set up in early 2001, before 9/11, because the Chinese were quite worried about what was happening in Afghanistan with the Taliban. Taliban comes to power in about 1996. By 2001, the Chinese government was worried that the Taliban was basically spreading a kind of, fundamentalist terroristic ideas in Uzbekistan, in the Uyghur regions, and so on. And so the Chinese assembled a group in Shanghai. The Central Asian countries, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and so on, India, Pakistan, Iran, all the countries around Afghanistan came to Shanghai and they created the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, whose task was to deal with the Taliban threat. And it's interesting, when 9/11 happened, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization said, "We're already set up, we're ready to, assist in any way." But the United States brushed them aside and said, "We don't need you. We've got NATO on our side, and basically it's military power, not diplomacy." Well, interesting move by the United States. If the United States had actually worked with the SCO, you may not have needed 20 years of war and then the Taliban comes back. They might have been able to clear up a lot of things with the Taliban in 2001. September, October, 20 years of war, so much loss of life, and now the Taliban is back in power. That was a really bad strategic decision by George W. Bush to dismiss the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. At any rate, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization continued to grow and now contains an enormously large number of countries, but more than that, 50% of the world's population is represented in the SCO, as I said. It's China, Russia, India, Pakistan. These are countries with very large populations. So half the world's population is represented in the SCO. The SCO meeting in Tianjin was going to be a big meeting. Putin was coming for that because he was then coming to the September 3rd gathering in Beijing. Out of nowhere, when Trump placed an enormous tariff on India for continuing to buy oil from Russia, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, instinctively pro-US. Instinctively, he is pro-US. But Mr. Modi decided to go to Tianjin, first time in 7 years that the Indian head of government has gone to China. It's enormously significant because previously there had been border clashes, two of them, between India and China. A lot of tension between India and China. So Modi's trip to China was very significant. He decided to go. In Tianjin, he had these photographs taken of him with Putin and Xi, which Modi's social media promoted. Then he went privately with Putin. They traveled together for a private travel and had a meeting together. This was also broadcast. He showed photographs of him and Putin talking together in a vehicle. This is very significant that India, ruled by a right-wing government, instinctively pro-US government, is in a sense snubbing the United States, going to China, meeting Xi, meeting Putin, and then deepening relations with Russia and saying, "We are not going to stop buying oil." You see, what's interesting is what Trump didn't say to the US public. India buys oil from Russia, lots of oil. That's partly because the Indian refining capacity is tooled to Russian grade oil. Every country has different grades of oil, different kinds of refining is necessary. You can rework your refineries, but it's just easier if you're buying the same grade of oil and it's good to go. Well, India refines Russian oil and then dot 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 sells it to Europe. So in a way, Russian oil is going through India to Europe. And this is bothering the United States because, they want to starve Europe of energy, so Europe becomes totally dependent on US energy. So India is refusing because a lot of money to be made in selling refined Russian oil to Europe. India is buying discounted price oil from Russia and selling market price refined products to the Europeans. India is making money on this. So there is a shift in the world order, and the United States is in a way in a difficult problem and is kind of caught between the horns of its own dilemma.
Yeah, so it's hard to overlook dear Trump's role in all these organizations, all these collaborations, his threats, his tariffs, his denigrating the leaders and the countries and calling them all kinds of bad names. I mean, Canada and Mexico are relooking at their relationship with us. Europe is pulling together because they don't trust America anymore. And then you have what's going on in China and with the Afghanistan alliance. The U.S. is going to end up with El Salvador, Israel, and I guess that's about it for allies. How do you think that's going to play out over the long term?
I mean, you listed the few that are there, but let's also be pretty straightforward about this, that Europe is increasingly subordinated itself to the US. You saw the very embarrassing photograph of Trump sitting behind the desk and the European leaders, being called to the headmaster's office or the principal's office or whatever they're just sort of sitting there like errant students, and Trump is berating them. I mean, they have infantilized themselves. They are not serious leaders any longer. So you're right, your list is correct, El Salvador, etc. But don't write the Europeans out of their miraculous devotion to the United States. This deep desire for the Atlantic connection, is it related to, let's say, some old fantasy about European or Western civilization? Who knows? Why won't Europe make a deal with the Russians? Why isn't that on the table for them? They would prefer to sunder ties with Eurasia and have an Atlantic connection. It's not logical. It's much cheaper for the Europeans to buy natural gas from Russia, to buy oil from Iran, much cheaper because those are piped. You don't have to have liquefied natural gas from the Gulf Coast. You're piping oil. It's much cheaper. The transport costs are hugely reduced. Why not? Well, this has got to do with other ideas of European ambitions to be superior. You don't want to make a deal with the Asians. You don't want to sit down at the table and say, okay, Iran, Russia, China, you are equal to us. You are humans. Let's talk. I mean, the Chinese aren't saying we want to do world conquest. They are saying, let's sit down, let's have a discussion, let's make a deal. I thought that was Trump's line. Let's make a deal. Not let's make the deal where we are the big deal. That's the sort of Western civilization ambition. We are the big deal and you are nothing. You have to just take orders from us. Well, now, to quote from Chairman Mao in 1949, it's not just that the Chinese people have stood up, but the people around the world have stood up. It's not just in Asia. The African people are standing up. They voted out corruption in Senegal. They decided to do away with the hapless elected officials in Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali. We're going to 2 years now on the 16th of September of the Alliance of Sahel States. People are standing up. They don't want, to be head bowed down before, the masters and so on. Latin America is complicated. We see a new effervescence coming out of Mexico. Real interesting political dynamic. 30 years in the making. This movement started in the 1980s, the movement that propelled Andrés Manuel López Obrador and now Claudia Sheinbaum to the presidency. This starts with Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, the son of Lázaro Cárdenas, the great, left of center president of Mexico in the 30s. It's a long time coming, this Morena movement. National, look at the name, National Regeneration Movement, Morena. Also, Andres Manuel, he coined the term fourth transformation. You know, the three previous transform, we need a fourth transformation. Mexico is on the move. Other parts of Latin America stumbling, you know, but holding forth. Venezuela, they haven't capitulated. Eight warships off the coast, 4,000 soldiers. Do you think 4,000 US soldiers can take on Venezuelan military of 150,000? I don't think so. I don't think they're waiting for an invasion. This is just strong arming and threats, you know. What are they going to do? Start bombing Caracas? What will you bomb? What will you
Wow.
bomb?
Wow.
So it's certainly true that the European leaders infantilized themselves, as you said. They were like school kids in the schoolmaster's office. But they're the leaders of countries, and they got to be deeply resentful, just as the Canadian leaders are deeply resentful, just as Claudia Sheinbaum is standing up to Trump. And I have to wonder if that won't change behavior. Because, I mean, we're only 8 months into the Trump regime. If he keeps it up, if his health sticks, he's going to keep embarrassing them, keep humiliating them, keep punishing them. I don't think they'll stand still for it forever.
But why do you not think that, Dick? That's an interesting. Let me hear you tell me why you think they
Okay,
won't.
I'll tell you why, because these people, those men and women, were all elected presidents of leaders of their country. They're highly elite in their own societies, and they see the same pictures of them sitting on the small stools being berated by this big fat man with an orange face, and it's got to burn in their souls. It's got to burn. Now, maybe they can't do anything about it right now, but they'll be on the lookout for an opportunity, I think.
So, if I could
Go,
just
yeah,
interject,
please.
I've always been interested in understanding the relationship between the personal and the geopolitical. I remember reading this book, Nicholas and Alexandra, Alexandra, which was about the last czar of Russia and the personal relationships between him and his wife and the Kaiser. And how some of those personal relationships actually became the kindling that started World War I. And I'm always judging, do we have elements? Are we seeing elements of that right now, where a single person who has such a disgusting, for lack of a better word, personality. Could he possibly, Xing said in this meetings yesterday, he declared the world stands at a crossroads between peace or war, positioning China as the bulwark against Western hegemony. I wonder, would this meeting have occurred in this way, but for Trump's personality?
Yeah, so I think it would have happened anyway. I think that this is a very important statement coming from the Asian countries, including Russia, because after all, it's not just Trump. Remember, the pivot to Asia, which really is an encirclement of China policy, starts under Barack Obama in 2011, when the United States starts to see Chinese economy really take off. And sees that as an existential threat to US economic control. So that encirclement of China is not a Trump issue. That was Obama, Trump, Biden, Trump. And it ran right through. Biden's statements on China were as jingoistic, sometimes more than Trump. So the Chinese are responding to an American policy, not to Trump. So that's there. But it's interesting. Let's go back to Europe and what Dick said about, well, you know, people may at some point stand up. It's true. But the timeline doesn't favor the Europeans. See, right now in the UK, Keir Starmer of the Labour Party has a commanding majority in the House of Commons, but his approval rating is rock bottom. And in the polls, it's not the Conservatives who have emerged as the major challenger. But it's Nigel Farage's Reform Party. which has emerged as the major opposition voice, and he is going hard against immigrants. You know, he has fashioned himself as a kind of British Trump. And Trump would love to see Keir Starmer's government fall and Nigel Farage come to power there. The French presidential election is in 2027. The calendar doesn't favor the Europeans because Trump will be in power till 2028 at least. God knows what happens after that. Some people say his son will run for president. Okay, you know, whatever it is, it's going to be Trumpian, you know, from the Republicans. It'll be a Trumpian presidency. Well, it doesn't favor the Europeans because in the French presidential election, unless some other new force emerges, it's going to be the far right that prevails there. So you already have a far right person in Italy. You'll have a far right in France. You might have a far right in Britain. And then we don't know what's going to happen in Germany, where the AfD, the Alliance for Deutschland, is growing in popularity. So what could happen in Europe is that the current crop of sort of milquetoast, you know, NATO-esque neoliberal people like Macron and Keir Starmer and so on could get thrown out of office, and you'd get a more hard right complexion in Europe. Then we are in for a real trouble, because then you've basically got the wave of the far extreme right across the Atlantic. And these groups, these people, I don't think they are well positioned to help dial down tensions in the world. You know, what was being said on September the 3rd in Beijing wasn't that, you know, we lost 50 million people, so we want to go to war against all of you. It was the opposite. You know, we fought to end fascism. We sacrificed a lot. We don't want to return to war and warfare. So these big countries of the global South are saying, stop this. We don't want war. We don't want military buildups. We'll do it if you insist, but we don't want it. We are capable of it, but we don't want it. And on the other side, the extreme right in Europe and the United States is like, let's go for war. That's our comparative advantage. And that scares me. And that's why I said, I don't know if Europe is going to move away from the United States, because they have this white supremacist idea of manifest destiny that crosses the Atlantic, you know, this idea of Western civilization and defending it. It's not just them. Javier Milei in Argentina is a great defender of Western civilization. You know, he goes to Davos previous year, 2024, gives a speech saying we must defend Christendom effectively, you know, against the savages, against the barbarians. And so this is what I think occupies the extreme right in the Atlantic world. And I think this is bad for humanity, you know,
Oh, absolutely.
not because of their personality, but because of their inability to dial down warfare.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you with this. When we talk about Western hegemony, what we're really talking about is a deeply held belief in white supremacy. And we see that at the micro level as well as at the macro level when we look at the United States. In domestic policy, we see white supremacy. And then when we look on the global stage of the European powers and the United States, I guess Japan might be part of that. I don't see how it fits. But we see that same thing of a belief in white supremacy. I want to talk a little bit about BRICS, this international economic coalition that, in my mind, although it is an economic coalition, is somehow related to the change in the powers, the global power structure. So it started off with these five countries: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. But there are almost 20 countries altogether that are somehow loosely or more tightly affiliated or wanting to be affiliated with BRICS. You want to talk about that, because it seems like when you add all these countries together, in terms of economics, you have more than 60%. First of all, you have more than 60% of the world population, but also a large percentage of the world's economic picture.
Yeah, I mean, See, the BRICS is interesting because obviously it provokes the idea, why does it appear in 2009? And that's not an accident. You have this major world financial crisis which really attacks the Atlantic world hard. I mean, US banks, European banks, and so on. And in countries like India, China, Indonesia, Brazil, South, these countries were horrified because they had geared their whole export oriented production towards the Western markets. And suddenly there's a demand crisis in the Western markets. People just don't have access to credit anymore. The credit crunch hits hard. So who's going to buy all these refrigerators produced in Shenzhen? Or who's going to use all this, this backroom office, assistance that was being provided by, armies of can I help you? My name is Rajesh from India. I mean, how are you going to get all these people employed if the Western market implodes? And so the BRICS, in a way, was a South-South business and enterprise. How do we trade with each other? If we're not going to rely on Western markets, let's trade with each other. China's Belt and Road comes in 2013. Basically, it's the same. How does China build new market relations with, say, India or African countries or Latin American countries and so on? That was the BRICS initially. It was basically a business decision. When the BRICS expansion came on the table, it's again very interesting that they invited all the oil producing countries. So now the BRICS Plus looks a lot like OPEC Plus. It has Saudi Arabia, Iran, with Russia. These are the major energy producers outside the United States. United States, one of the world's largest energy producers. But outside the US, almost everybody is in the BRICS. When Venezuela eventually joins the BRICS, Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves. Everybody will be in BRICS Plus. So then the economic power of the BRICS bloc is going to be considerable because it will monopolize most of the world's energy. Then we'll see what happens. Right now, BRICS hasn't actually mobilized its OPEC plus power in a way that sort of hurts anybody else. But I will say that as a consequence of the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline that took pipe gas from Russia to Germany, as a consequence of that, as a consequence of sanctions on Russia, the Russians have built these two Siberia pipelines, one that goes around Mongolia into northern China, the industrial belt of northern China, the other that goes through Mongolia. And in fact, therefore, Mongolia gets the kind of transit fees that Ukraine was benefiting from. And these two pipeline Siberia 1 and Siberia 2, are going to take natural gas from the peninsulas of the Arctic North in Russia into China, and then further from China into other parts of Asia, Vietnam, maybe even eventually into India. And this is actually a problem because now we are seeing Russia effectively create infrastructure for its energy to no longer go to Europe. So even if the war ends in Ukraine, there is no guarantee that the Russians will restart energy supplies to Europe because the market in Asia is enormous. And there's no Nord Stream pipeline. You'd have to rebuild that pipeline. And by the time that happens, Siberia 1 and 2 will be in operation. And the Russians may not have any need to sell to the Europeans. The Iranians are already selling to the Chinese and would like a pipeline to go to India. So you're going to see a lot of infrastructure in Asia that's going to cut out the Europeans. And this can have, 50 to 75 year impact, which is a generation plus impact on Europe's ability to secure energy. Europe reliant on US energy is going to face multiple decades of fuel inflation, which then feeds into food price inflation. Because if your fuel costs are high and you're importing food and you have to transport food, food costs go up. This has serious problems for household incomes because then your energy and your food prices go up. Well, what's left? I mean, you'll have no money left for leisure. And so cultural life in Europe will decline. I mean, I'm putting it in stark terms, but I also want to suggest that the emergence now of BRICS Plus and the break with Russia is going to have energy consequences for, Western, let's use the term Western civilization.
Wow. We started this discussion and you talked about your organization. Repeat the URL, please, for the listening audience.
Yeah, it's the Tricontinental. It's a bit of a mouthful. The THE Tricontinental.org. And basically, everything I'm saying is all ideas that are collaboratively developed in our organization. So this is, you want to read more about this, you get more detailed information at the website.
Absolutely. What you do, VJ, if we when we listen to just regular corporate media, even independent media, we don't get this depth of analysis. We kind of just get, Russia bad, United States good, kind of reductionism. And it makes it very difficult to understand what we see playing out right before our eyes. It also makes it difficult to understand our own personal vulnerability. And that's where I like to bring it. I like to bring it to our own personal vulnerability. I look at situations where countries are at war, and I think to myself, the people who are being harmed the most, did they at any point try to understand or try to weigh in on their legislative bodies if they had them, but way beforehand? Because the people who pay the price of not understanding this and not taking the reins in their own hand, the people who pay the price are the most vulnerable.
I mean, let's take the case of Russia. When Russia invaded Ukraine, the United States government under Joe Biden made statements saying, we've never seen such a bad violation of the UN Charter. No country since the end of World War II has invaded another country like this, and so on. I mean, if you're sitting in New Delhi or in if you're sitting in La Paz or, wherever, Lusaka, you're laughing because. Or if you're sitting in Baghdad, you're crying because you're thinking, hey, wait a minute, you illegally invaded us, Iraqis, in 2003. That was an illegal invasion. You destroyed the country. You illegally destroyed Libya because in Libya's case, there was a UN Security Council resolution. But if you go back and read Resolution 1973 from 2011, all the resolution says is no arms shipments to either side in the conflict, and any member state can create a no-fly zone. But it doesn't say you're allowed to bomb government buildings, and you're allowed to bomb military bases, and you're allowed to assassinate leaders, let Gaddafi be killed and disable his car so that a militia grabs him, sodomizes him, and then kills him. That was not in the UN Security Council resolution. Okay, that was not there. That the destruction of Libya is a violation of international law. It's also a war crime. Where are they? We're talking George W. Bush, Tony Blair, Barack Obama, who also oversaw the drone killings, illegal assassinations, including of US citizens, including a 16-year-old boy who was a US citizen in Yemen. Barack Obama signed off on his execution without a judge in the room, and he's a lawyer. Where is Nicolas Sarkozy? Where are all these people? They're all war criminals. If we're going to be serious about violations of the UN Charter, send them to the Hague. Why only Putin? Why only Netanyahu? Where's the warrant for George W. Bush, who opens the door to complete impunity? So in that sense, I mean, if you're sitting in the United States, and as you said, there's a kind of media, thing, and people say, oh my God, I can't believe Russia is doing this. I mean, what is Russia doing that the United States has not done? That doesn't make it right. It just should make people less sanctimonious. That you're going to have a peace deal with the Russians at some point. They are not, 10-headed monsters. If they are 10-headed monsters, so are you.
That's right.
So are you. I mean, Iraqi See, he's a Iraqi kid who was, 5 years old in 2003, is now in his or her 20s. They see an American walking down the street, they may be scared, thinking, "Oh my God, they're going to blow my mother's head off again." It's like a Palestinian kid. People on the ground, medical workers are saying that, muteness has increased among children, that many of them no longer can speak because they are so traumatized. Amnesia is setting in. So they are diagnosing amnesia, muteness. These are things that they are seeing among children in Palestine. So, I mean, what do you, why do people in places like the United States feel that they are superior to others? You've done it to others and worse, you dropped two nuclear bombs. I mean, for God's sake, the only country to drop nuclear bombs on civilian targets or on any target. Don't be superior, just be an ordinary person. Nothing wrong with being just a person. What's wrong with that? Why does one have to be superior?
But it goes back even further. I mean, after all, we wiped out the native population in the whole continent, and
That's
then
right.
we built a country on the backs of black slaves. So I mean, and I don't think we've ever made peace with that or
Never.
reconciled with it, or like in South Africa had a say, yes, this is what we did. I mean, some people do. But it's not like deep in our soul that we recognize that. And I think that plays out in our treatment of other people around the world. I mean, now we're shooting down speedboats in the Caribbean, pretending that they got drugs in them. And what if they got drugs in them? That doesn't mean you kill 18 people,
Well, Vijay, as usual, it's a very informative, information-packed conversation,
Indeed.
and I strongly encourage people to read Vijay's books, to go to the tricontinental.org, and to follow the works of this man who just has so much important information to share. Thank you, Vijay.
Well, before I leave, I would also like to say that I'm really proud and happy that LA Progressive is part of the Globetrotter network and runs so many of our Globetrotter pieces. So
Right.
if people want to read the Globetrotter work, it's at LA Progressive. You don't have to go any further than that.
Thank you. Thank you, Vijay. Okay, have a
Bye.
great day. And hopefully the next time we talk, we can talk about happy things.
Well, maybe about sports. That's what I actually like talking about. Okay. Take care of yourselves.
Thank you for sticking around. If you like the LA Progressive content and the discussions we have here, please consider clicking the subscribe button below and also give us a thumbs up. That helps to grow our audience by feeding the algorithm, which helps to get this content in front of more eyes. Thanks for stopping by. We really appreciate your support.